Hey y'all. My name's Lauren. I'm an alcoholic. And where I live, we give our dry dates. And I have truly, by the grace of God, I have been sober since April the 6th of 1987, and I am extremely grateful for that today. And I'm delighted to be here. When Chris called and said, you know, we'd like for you to come to Kentucky, I thought, that's great. I've never been to Lexington before. And then I looked at the weather like a week ago, and it was like 60. I'm in. You know what I mean? I looked at the weather last night, and I was not as excited. It's hilarious that you brought speakers from like California, Louisiana, and Texas, and you're going to have to watch us hibernate for the weekend. We will be the people that are under things, right? We will be bundled all weekend. It's beautiful. I stopped and took a video and sent it to my granddaughter. It's snowing. We never get that where I live, and that's why I live there. It's not the only reason I live there, but it's in the top three. Anyway, it's a privilege to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous and thank Lindsay. She's been a wonderful host. We had a great lunch today, and everybody that does the heavy lifting, right? This is the easy thing. This is not service, by the way. Sharing my experience, strength, and hope is just sharing my experience, strength, and hope. It's the least we can do in Alcoholics Anonymous. The service is in setting up this room and making the coffee and coordinating the host and the speakers and the flyers and the ASL. By the way, to the interpreter, I'll buy you a gift tomorrow. Hang on. I saw them sign it and I thought, oh man, you know? Somewhere in my brain will be the idea that I should slow down, but I don't really have the capacity to do that. So, this is a privilege, right? It's the least I can do. And what a gift to be able to come anywhere. I go across the street and share my experience, strength, and hope about what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. Every good thing that I have in my life today is a direct result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the fellowship. My life is radically changed as a direct result of the directions that are outlined in the first 164 pages of that book. I spent time in the fellowship, and I was not recovering. I was having a lot of fun. The amends list was epic, but there wasn't any recovery going on. So what I'm asked to do, you know, what the book says, a couple of things about this, what I'm doing tonight, and it says, you know, that we share our personal stories so that we can share our experience and how we established a relationship with a power greater than ourselves. And it also says that we share in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. And that gets misquoted like crazy, probably not in Kentucky, but in Texas, that gets misquoted like crazy, and people say what it used to be like and what happened and what it's like now. And I always make a point of talking about this because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 17. And if my it had needed to match those old people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous where I was, if that my it had needed to match their it, I could not have stayed. I did not have that story yet. I did not have the bankruptcies and the divorces and all the chaos that comes when we drink for long periods of time. But I for sure had alcoholism. And I was very blessed to land in a room full of people that were talking about what it used to be like, untreated alcoholism, right? They shared about their untreated alcoholism. They shared about their recovery from untreated alcoholism. They shared about how they stayed in recovery from untreated alcoholism. And that ability, that allowed me to identify. I didn't want to be here, right? But I knew when I listened to you share. I mean, I thought you were all lying about being sober, so let's just be honest about that. Because you seemed happy and not drinking. And I didn't think that was really an available option when I got here. But I heard them share about their untreated alcoholism, and I heard them share about recovery, and I heard them share about how their lives have been transformed by practicing the principles that are outlined in those steps and the traditions. Right? And it's sometimes easier to practice the principles that are outlined in the steps because that gets me in right relationship with God, and that's all warm and fuzzy, and I love it, and it's wonderful. Those traditions are a whole other ball of wax because I don't even sometimes want to practice the traditions principles because I don't want to be in right relationship with you. because you're wrong. And you're not listening. You know what I mean? And I have a sponsor who's really big on practicing traditions and all of my affairs, and it's a conversation. It's an ongoing conversation. I'm not there yet. Anyway, I will tell you very quickly that, I just was never okay. And I don't really know what that's about. I was never comfortable doing what I was doing with the people I was doing it with while I was doing it. And from the word go. And I was born into a large Italian family. They loved me. I was the first child, the first grandchild, the first great-grandchild. And so when I say that I was well-loved, I don't mean that they did the best they could. I mean, I was well-loved. I just couldn't receive that. And that wasn't on them, right? They were wonderful people. My extended family was full of really amazing people. I had two of the greatest grandmothers God ever put on the earth. I just could not receive that, right? When you paid attention to me, it turned into a narcissistic tantrum. Just from the word go, just a gift I have, you know what I mean? You could say, oh, you look cute today, and I would turn that into, I am better than everybody here. And I would act that way and then run people off, and I couldn't figure out why anybody didn't want to be in the sandbox with me, you know what I mean? So I was telling him how to work the dump truck. And so... It was not an easy thing to be me. I was not comfortable. Now, I lived in an alcoholic home, but I say that because later on in my story, that will be relevant. It had nothing to do with me and my untreated alcoholism and my drinking and the way that that worked out in my life, other than it was super handy. Now, I grew up in Austin, Texas in the late 60s and 70s, and when my folks went out, we went with them. And they'd take, with their friends, they'd take eight kids to the bar to go dancing. We'd all go in the honky-tonk, and we'd sit under the tables and take beers and hang out, and we'd play dice or play cards or whatever, and our parents would dance and drink, and they'd go out with eight kids. Sometimes it was a different eight kids, but they'd count eight going in and count eight coming out, you know what I mean? But it was awesome. It was just a wonderful little college town, and it was safe, and I had a great childhood in spite of how uncomfortable I was. I had an excellent childhood, but my reaction to life was a little off. And so when I was six, my little untreated Al-Anon mama was very much about, you're going to sit down and you're going to be quiet and you'll play by the rules and dot your I's and cross your T's and whatever the opposite of that is what I got, right? And so she decided when I was six that what would help me, because I had already become the problem, that what would help me was structure. So we're going to sign up for Girl Scouts. Now, I don't like people. I don't like uniforms. I don't like rules. I don't like group activities. Arts and crafts are dumb. So sure, Girl Scouts. What could possibly go wrong there? So she signs me up for Girl Scouts, and we drive over to this little annex of this church down from where we lived, and she said, you go in that door right there, and I'm going to go around the corner and park the car. And I got out of the car and probably said something like, yes, ma'am, because I was six. You know what I mean? And so I got out of the door and said, yes, ma'am. She ran around the corner to park, and I left. Then I went a mile and a half to a friend's house. I broke into their house. I made myself a tuna fish sandwich. I stole their dog, and I went and hid out in their pool house. That's the skill set I had, right? I just leave. I don't like it here. I'm leaving. And that was my first skill set. My second skill set, look, she tapped out. I broke the first ASL. I love that so much, y'all. That's so great. They're probably going to run in 10-minute shifts. 20-minute shifts. My bad. Also, I don't have a watch. Will you, somebody, give me a watch. I have no idea what time it is. Somebody just, when I'm close to an hour, somebody should wave at me. I don't even know what time I started. When I get close to an hour, somebody will. Y'all get sick of listening to me? Somebody throw a chair up here and I'll quit talking. That's the first skill set that I learned. The other thing that happened in my house is that my mother cried all the time. And my dad raged all the time. And so my mother would stand at the kitchen sink washing dishes, and we'd go in and say, "Mama, what's wrong?" And she'd go, "Nothing." Right? She thought that was dumb. And my dad, on the other hand, was pretty much getting his way. Right? He was living the life he wanted to live. He went where he wanted to go. He drank when he wanted to drink. He hung out with people he wanted to hang out with. All that stuff was happening. I'm not an idiot. Right? I watch him. I watch her. I want that. Right? Yeah. I want what he's got. Right? And I began to pursue that in the way that I knew how to do that. And so my dad would get angry, and my dad would slam doors, and things would get different. And when I get backed into a corner, I'd get angry, and I would slam doors. And things would get different. Not better, necessarily, but different. And so I became angry, and I learned how to leave. And the anxiety that I lived with, I always describe it as I was born with an overdeveloped sense of self. I just had this acute awareness of how I was doing all the time. And how I felt and what I was thinking and what you were thinking and what you thought about what I was doing and if you were going to interfere with my plan and what did I need to do to make sure you didn't interfere with my plan and how was I going to get away with what I wanted to get away. It was exhausting in my head, right? And there was this knot in my gut, and I was just never enough. It was just, I never could pull it off. I could always see the right thing to do. You know, I always knew what it was supposed to look like. And I just couldn't get from where I was to there. Somewhere in between where I was and the next right thing, I'd set fire to the planet. And I lived that way, right? And it was just this, it was an awful, awful thing. And until I got to alcohol. And part of my problem when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous is that I thought you guys were talking about a drinking problem. And I didn't have a drinking problem. I had a drinking solution. I had a sober problem. Right? I don't like not drinking. So this general idea that you should just stop drinking, we're not even on the same planet. Right? Not only are we not going to have this conversation, we're not even on the same planet. The first time that I got drunk on purpose, I was in Omaha, Nebraska. I'm a baseball junkie. And I was in Omaha, Nebraska at the College World Series, unchaperoned with the University of Texas baseball team. That's a whole nother thing, but it indicates how sick my parents were of me. Also, it was the 80s, and we were feral. So our parents were like drinking tab and smoking Salem Lights and watching soap operas, and we were robbing banks and playing on the railroad tracks, and you know what I mean? Like, it was just the way it was. And so I went to Omaha, Nebraska, and supervised with the University of Texas baseball team. It used to be at this old place called the Holodome, which isn't there anymore. It was this giant, cool hotel where all the teams would be. And there was a cooler beer at one end of the row of chairs, and I was sitting on the ground at the other end of the row of chairs. And they just started passing down beers. And I'm just this kid sitting on the floor. I just started stashing beers. I just intuitively knew I was going to need more money. You know what I mean? And finally, somebody on the other end said, What happened to all the beer? And they said, the kids got it. And everybody thought that was hilarious. Nobody tried to take it from me. And the next thing I remember, I'm in a car with a bunch of people I don't know looking at a sign that says, you are now leaving Des Moines, Iowa. Now, I'm from the middle of Texas. If you wake up in another state, you've been gone a minute. You know what I mean? Turns out, Omaha and Des Moines, not that far apart. Omaha's a dry county. People go to Des Moines. All that, it's not that big a deal, right? I didn't know that. And so I kind of panicked, right? And the guy sitting next to me said, it's fine. And I was like, okay. Because what happens for me when I drink, and it happens every time that I drink, it's not that alcohol is, I shouldn't say it's a solution. The only solution I've ever found for my untreated alcoholism is outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But what alcohol gave me was much needed relief from the spiritual malady. Now, I didn't know it was a spiritual malady. But I just couldn't. I went into every drink with my jaw clenched and my fist clenched and a knot in my gut and just looking for something to break to make me feel better, right? It was just so wound so tight. And I'd get, not the first drink, by the way. This thing that we say in Alcoholics Anonymous, first drink that gets you drunk. I thought that was the dumbest thing I'd ever heard in my life. Not the way I drank. Because I didn't understand what was wrong with me, right? It wasn't the first drink. The only thing any first drink ever did for me is make me thirsty. I never got anything from the first drink except a demand for the second one. And that second one was okay, but, right? Not enough. I love the third drink. Man, I love the third drink. Everything just... settles in at the third drink, right? My shoulders drop, my mind starts to kind of disconnect. And it's not that I'm relieved of the bondage of self when I drink. It's that I don't care, right? Maybe I'm still a selfish lunatic, right? I'm probably still the same jerk I was before I had three drinks. I just don't care, right? The problem is, three is so good that you got to continue to drink to maintain that sensation that happens at three, right? And so somewhere between four and however many, I would black out. And I would put myself in hock. And I would violate my value system. And I would hurt people that I cared about. And I would create chaos and damage. And that was, I just wanted the sense of ease and comfort that came with taking a few drinks. Silkworth doesn't say a drink. Silkworth says the sense of ease and comfort that comes with a few. Because I need a few to get me to that place, right? And if I could just figure out, the book says it's, you know, the obsession is that someday we'll be able to control and enjoy our drinking. I got to tell you, my great obsession was, it's not now, my great obsession now is that I could spend every minute of every day right here in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's my great obsession, right? I chase that like I would chase a drink. But my obsession when I was drinking is I want to drink like I drink and not pay consequences, right? I want to drink all I can get all the time, live however I want, and not pay consequences. Why can't that be a thing, you know? It's not a thing. So what happened for me is that I didn't realize when I came back from that trip to Omaha that I had set off the phenomenon of craving. I didn't realize that I was about to burn my whole life to the ground to find that place where it wasn't so hard to breathe, where it wasn't so painful to be me, but I for sure did. And I began to aggressively pursue the opportunity to drink every chance I had. Now, I was 13, 14 years old, so that wasn't all day, every day, right? But very quickly, it was every weekend. And then very quickly, it was Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then it was Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, right? And before you know it, the school's saying, "Where is she?" right? And I want to tell you what happened for me. This is my favorite part of the story, my story. I love to tell this. What happened for us is that in the summer of 1985, my poor little mother had had just about all she could stand. She's now had two active alcoholics in her home, although she did not know that because we didn't have alcoholism in our family. But she had two active alcoholics in the house, and my little brother was just busy trying to be good. And she was just a mess. And so she kicked my dad out. And she wanted him to quit drinking, and he told her what she could do with that idea, and she told him he had to get out. My parents loved each other like you wouldn't believe. They've been together since they were in high school, and this was not a contentious thing. It was devastating to her. But we didn't know we had alcoholism. My father was working with a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. We didn't know that. And that man did what we are all asked to do. And he picked up the phone and he called my mother, who he had never met or spoken to, and said, "Stephanie, my name is Jerry, and I understand you kicked Bill out for his drinking." And my mother said, "Yes, I did." Yeah, that's all she ever described. And he said, "I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you be interested in going to an open AA meeting with me tonight?" Y'all, my mother would have gone to Guam. You know what I mean? Because my parents loved each other. We didn't know what was wrong. And she's, "Yes, I'll go." Well, so the first thing that happened is this amazing man carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to my family. It is really the least we can do to pick up the phone. But because he made that call, my mother joined the Al-Anon family group and has been an active member since July the 24th of 1985 in the Al-Anon family groups. Yep. August the 6th of 1985, my father went to treatment and was sober until the day he died. Everybody that they sponsored, and everybody that they sponsored, my opportunity to get sober, and everybody that I have helped, and everybody that they have helped, is because one member of Alcoholics Anonymous picked up the phone and said, "My name is Jerry and I'm an alcoholic. Would you like to go to an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with me tonight?" That's powerful stuff. Right? The book says, why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered. And the only power we ever get back, right? I've been given the power to help others. Wow. Right? And what do I got to do? Call? Okay. Right? I can handle that. My mother went to Al-Anon, and my father went to treatment, and then the most horrific thing ever in the history of the world happened, and you people showed up at our house. And I hated you. So I'm a chronic teenage alcoholic. I'm drunk. I'm angry. I'm edgy. I got a chip on my shoulder, right? And you guys are like, we just think your parents are precious, and isn't this amazing, and we're so grateful. Do you want to pray? Right? I mean, we went from... Right, like people talk about recovery is slow. It ain't slow. Like on Monday, he's loaded, and on Tuesday, we're praying. Right, and I'm not okay with any of it. So, yeah, they're all praying. It was great. They very quickly said, well, let me say this. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it is so divinely created, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, they give a definition of a heavy drinker. And they said, if a person is a heavy drinker, they may be able to moderate or stop altogether if given sufficient reasons, such as loss of home, loss of income, loss of family, loss of health. I'm so grateful that was in there. And this is why. What happened for me is they said, you can't drink like you drink and live. My alcoholism said, see, I knew you didn't love me. I'm out of here. My boss said, you can't come to work drunk, Laura. Right? I said, my alcoholism said, I don't need a sorry job. I was just about to quit anyway. My friend said, we can't be around you anymore. The way you behave when you're drinking is too much. My alcoholism said, I don't need friends like you anyway. I'll go find me some people that understand me. School said, you can't bring beer to first period. So close-minded. My alcoholism said, I don't need this. I'm gone. The most baffling thing for me about alcoholism is that as it is robbing me of the things that I value the most in my life, it makes it look like it was my idea. If you had asked me, I would have said, I left my house. I quit my job. I don't even want that stupid education. Those friends are lame. It sounded like I made a decision to be on the street. Now, I did say that. I would say, I'm out here. But the decision was made because I'd been so poorly treated, you know. Right? It wasn't like I was being accountable for my behavior. Let's be clear. It was a sad, sad story. I could not see that I was chasing the sense of ease and comfort that comes with a few drinks. I could not see it. And I had heard all this stuff because I had to suffer through family week. And none of that applied to me. And I would drink and tell my friends what genes were misfiring in my head. You know what I mean? It was just awesome. And so what happened for me is what happens to anybody that lives on the streets. It was awful. It was painful, and there was a lot of bad stuff that went down. And I believe the reason that I got to come to you at 17 is because both of my parents were active members in the Al-Anon family groups and Alcoholics Anonymous, and very effectively sponsored. They didn't give me a nickel. They didn't make a sandwich. They didn't come get me. They didn't check. Right? They prayed. I know that now. Right? But they didn't come after me. My dad said, you think you know so much, hotshot, get after it. And they left me to it. And so April the 4th of 1987, I'm a mouthy sober person, in case you haven't caught that yet. I'm really mouthy sober. I was terrible when I was drinking. I'd pick fight with anybody. And April the 4th of 1987 was a really bad night for me. And April the 5th of 1987 was a little bit worse than that. And I'd taken a tire tool to the side of my head and had some broken ribs. I weighed 198 pounds. I was sweating alcohol. I was drinking around the clock. And I couldn't get out of here anymore. That's what I wanted. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I wanted out of here. That was my effect. I got to go. Can't be here. Alcohol did that. And it wasn't. I was aware. I heard a speaker a couple years ago describe it as drunk from the neck down. I was drunk and aware, of how I was living and who I was hurting and the values that I was violating and the way that I was, you know, what was going on in my life. And I called a friend, collect from a payphone. I know there's some people in here who don't know what that is. Google it. Huh? And so I knew there was, I called my friend Colette from a payphone, and my first miracle is that she answered, and I said, I'm hurt, can I come over? And she said yes, and I did that. And I went to her house, and I think she was surprised when I got there. And so she said I could stay. And that night in her bathroom, I had a thought. I used to say I said a prayer, but I don't really think I was praying because I really knew God was done with me. I'd been raised in the church, you know what I mean? Like, I know. But I thought, if you can't make it better, make it stop. And I for sure wasn't talking about drinking. Right? I was just done. I hurt everywhere. My hair hurt. I was so tired I couldn't lift my head up off the bathroom floor. And my friend had called my parents. The next morning I got up and had a cold Lone Star and a stale taco. And somebody knocked on the door, and it was my folks. And they said, are you willing to stop drinking? Now, if you're new, please listen. I said, yes, I am. And they said, are you willing to do whatever we ask you to do? I said, yes, I am. They said, will you go to treatment? Yes, I will. I didn't mean a word of it. I believe the single greatest thing that's ever happened to me, any day, pick any day in the last 54 and some change years, the single greatest thing that has ever happened to me is that morning, that moment, I had no plan. I couldn't think anybody to call. I couldn't come up with how I could get some money. I had a pair of flip-flops, cutoffs, a hoodie, a bad attitude, a closed mind, and 37 cents. That's what I brought to you in Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? And I had a sponsor for 22 years. He used to point that out all the time. And I would say, well, you know, my house. And he'd go, your house? Really? Really? That's your house? All that stuff in there is yours too? How'd you get that to detox? Whatever. I agreed to do all kinds of stuff I didn't mean to do. What I meant to do was to rest up until I could get a plan. That's all I meant to do. I for sure did not mean to be with you for 36 years. I didn't. We say if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it. I was not. I didn't want what you had. I went across the room to get what you had. I couldn't stand what you had. You prayed, you laughed, you gathered, you hugged, you drank coffee. It was horrible. I didn't want any part of it. I just didn't have anywhere else to go. I was 118 days removed from my last drink before I had my first honest desire to stay sober. I believe that I had to start feeling better before I could look back and see how sick I had gotten. And at 118 days, I did not want what you had, but I no longer wanted what I had. At 118 days, the idea of going back to the streets was more than I could handle. I just, no. Because I'd been indoors for a while, and I'd been bathing regularly, and I'd been brushing my teeth and having meals, and, you know. And at the same time, how do I do that? Because I can't not drink. I can't be sober. And I would come to your meetings, and I would listen to you talk about sobriety is amazing. What's wrong with me is not what's wrong with you then. Because sobriety is not amazing. Sobriety is like people are firing cruise missiles at my head every 8 seconds. You know what I mean? And I'm just like, life is like ducking and dodging and trying to put out this fire to get that. I came back to Austin and I joined the Northland Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I became very, very busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. Very busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to a meeting every day for 5 years and 2 months. I know that because I gave birth 5 years, 2 months, and 1 day. I went into labor at my home group. And it was a whole event, right? And they were so desperate for me to not be pregnant anymore. They were like, anything we can do to get her out of here. You know what I mean? I was the most miserable, sober, pregnant woman you've ever seen in your life. That was in the middle. But I went to a meeting every day for 5 years and 2 months. Now, I'm not one of these people that believes that just going to meetings will keep you sober. I don't believe that. But what I do believe, we do a disservice to people when we say, oh, you know, meeting makers make it, isn't true. Here's the deal. I went to a meeting every day for 5 years and 2 months, and the result of that was when The wheels fell off, and I had burned it to the ground, and I could not suck air sober. I was in so much pain. I was accidentally at a meeting because I had developed a habit of coming to you every single day at 5:30. Did the meetings treat my alcoholism? No. But when my alcoholism had me by the back of the neck, I drove to a meeting I don't remember driving to. I ended up in the parking lot of my home group without my permission. It's the truth. That's the truth, right? I just left work and went there every day. I just left work and went to my home group every day. And I accidentally ended up there. So let me tell you what happened. I met a him. Now listen. We say don't get in a relationship for a year, but we don't know if that's true or not because no one's ever done it. This is AA hearsay. If you can find it in the book, come argue with me about it. It's not there. The spiritual benefits from a hymn are immeasurable. I don't know why we discourage it. Get a girlfriend, by God. Bring her to the meeting. Let us meet her. You know what I mean? Bring her to coffee afterwards. Tell us your plans about moving in together. We know you've known each other for 3 days. We think that's great. Please. Right? And listen, for me, anything... How much time do I have left? A little bit? I'm good. Okay. Anything that would give me just a little relief to allow me to stay was okay with me. But I got a him, and no two people have ever been less compatible than me and him. And we knew it in the first 30 minutes. So we stayed together for 3 years. Because we're not quitters. You know what I mean? And we would bring our chaos to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would share in the meeting, and he would rebuttal. And he would share in the meeting, and I would rebuttal. We had the whole group involved, you know. So I'm 4 years and 2 months-ish away from a drink. I'm about 4 years away from a drink at this point, and some well-meaning member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who was probably just desperate for us to shut up, pulled him off to the side one day and said, you know, the next time things start getting heated, you should just take a little break. Just step away. Did you know it's in the big book? It's in there. It's just when it gets a little heated, just pause. Right? What? So, he's following directions. I'm not. He's following directions. We get a little heated. He says, I'm just going to step outside for a minute. Right? No, you're not. Are you new here? You know what I mean? He said, I'm just going to take a little break. I'm not leaving. I'll be back. I was like, oh, buddy, that's not how this is going to go. You know? So he goes outside and gets in his truck. I go outside, right? And I'm still blah, 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 right? And he locks the doors to the truck, which is a fairly sane move at this point. And but I just got in the bed of the truck. And I'm not getting out. He's getting mad. Now he's mad. He's unpaused, and it ain't good, right? I'm in the back of the truck like a lunatic, and I'm yelling at him to get out of the truck. Let's finish whatever. I'm not done talking to you yet. And we lived across the street from a mall. And so his plan was to go to the mall, right? So he drives me in the back of the truck across the street to this mall and starts hitting the speed bumps in that mall parking lot, trying to bounce me out of the truck. And I had a death grip on the side rail of the bed of the truck, right? And I'd go up and come down, bang on that back window, and he'd speed up and hit the next one. I always like to pause here and say, I'm so grateful we didn't have a little AA sticker on the back of my car. No circle and triangle for us. No friends of Bill. Thank God. I've never had one, right, for this specific reason. Because it could just get away from you at any time. You know what I mean? And then people see it and they're like, oh my God. Anyway. So I'm not getting out of the bed of the truck, and he's mad now. He's all engaged. And the car, and the mall kind of was across the corner, around the corner from a car wash. So he pulls into this car wash. It's a fairly safe bet, right? I mean, let me tell you, this is, I tell this story for one, because it's hilarious, but also because this is what my untreated alcoholism looks like, going to meetings every single day, being active in Alcoholics Anonymous, carrying meetings to newcomers, answering the phones, doing 12-step calls. I had service commitments. I was at the area assemblies. I was at the conventions. I was doing all the things except, right? I was active and busy in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is what it looked like for me. He pulls up to that car wash, and my mind, if I get out of the truck, he wins. It is not happening. He goes through, and I always say this, but it's the truth. Every time I tell this story, I can see his face in the rearview mirror just like, oh my God. There was no ability. So he goes to the car wash, and I go through the car wash, and I'm down. I'm a drowned rat, right? And I'd come up in between washes and bang on that window. Okay, so listen, if you do that in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's going to get you talked about, as it should. Like, if you're going to behave like that, you should grow some skin, because we're going to be talking about you when you walk in. Right? But it won't kill you. But what we did next will. I went home, I got in the shower, I got cleaned up, and I went to the 5:30 meeting. And when I walked in the meeting, everybody said, how you doing? I said, good, good, how are you? I was entirely fraudulent with the members of my home group. There was not a single person on the planet that knew how I was doing. No one really knew what was going on in that house. No one knew how uncomfortable I was. And I was dying from untreated alcoholism, sitting in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. June the 11th of 1991, I ended up at a meeting without my permission, out of habit. And I went in. I went into the meeting because they used to say, if you're going to leave, come tell us. And I went in there and raised my hand and said, I can't stay here with you people anymore. Your lives are getting better, and whatever you have, I don't have. My case must be different because I'm trying, and it's awful. And it was, y'all. And there wasn't even anything wrong yet. You know what I mean? Like, it was all self-imposed crisis. Life hadn't even started happening yet. And I said, I can't stay here. And there was one guy in the room that raised his hand, and he said, please don't leave. My second big miracle is that I didn't leave, because my alcoholism looks like this. I'm dying. I can't suck air. My life is as unmanageable as you can imagine. There's nothing but chaos and lies and dishonesty and fraudulent behavior all day, every day in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was the untrustworthy member. I'm a taker. And when that guy raised his hand and said, don't leave, I've been where you are, I can help you, I thought, you don't know what, you have no idea. You can't help me. It's a miracle that I didn't get up and walk out of that meeting. But I didn't. And after the meeting, we went out on the back porch, and he sat across from me on this bench, and you know, my old timers were kind. And he said, you're a spoiled, rotten, vain little brat. He said, you want somebody else to do your recovery for you, and that ain't how it works here. He said, you don't even know what's wrong with you. You think you got a drinking problem. And he said, you've never bothered to open that book. You've never bothered to follow the directions. And we don't get it by osmosis. He said, Alcoholics Anonymous is not for people that want it. Alcoholics Anonymous is for sure not for people that need it. Alcoholics Anonymous is only for people that do it, and you have never bothered to take any of the actions that are the program of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he said, if you will start to the forward of the first edition and do every single thing it says to do to page 164, you will never feel this hopeless again. And if you do, I'll finance your drunk. And he had me. And he didn't have me because I believed Alcoholics Anonymous would work for me. And he didn't have me because I wanted a relationship with God. He had me because he said he would finance my drunk. And I said, write it down. And he did. And I have that napkin. It's on a little white coffee napkin. And it's dated June the 11th of 1991. And he signed it. And it is in my God box. And it is one of my most prized possessions. Because that day, I entered into a contract. And I became a student of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am here to tell you that I took every action that was outlined in that book. I didn't believe in any of it. I said all the prayers. I didn't mean any of them. I didn't want a relationship with God. I didn't care about the inventory. I don't even care. I'm just taking the action to get to that finance my drunk. The steps work without my permission. I took every single action that was outlined in that book, and I have never been as hopeless as I was that afternoon on that back porch. And life has thrown me some heavy stuff. But the steps work without my permission. I don't have to believe it. I don't have to feel it. I don't have to think it. I don't have to agree with it. In fact, I frequently don't out loud, right? I have a sponsee who every time he writes inventory, he calls me and goes, "This is dumb." And I'm like, "I know, right? I agree." Right? And then he'll just hang up, you know? And I'm like, "I got it. I get it. It is dumb. How does this work? Why does me putting pen to paper and looking at God, please help me to resolutely look for my own mistakes? Shut up. Right? I don't want to do that." But when I'm free. And what's happened is the 10-step promises. Now, we read the 9-step promises to death. And I'm not knocking the 9-step promises, but we have started reading them to death. If it's my meeting and I'm in charge of it, which I'm not currently in charge of any meetings, but if I were in charge of a meeting, we'd read those 10-step promises. The problem has been removed. I have not sworn off. I do not wake up in the morning and say, "I choose not to drink today." My book tells me I don't have the power of choice in drink. I do not wake up in the morning and say, "Me and God, we got it," right? "Me and God, nothing. Me and God, I'm dragging God around by the back of the shoe." You know what I mean? God. Just God. And I don't know how to get to God. I have no idea how to get to that power. I don't define it. The first time I went through the steps, I read that line in Bill's story that said, "A God that was personal to me of love, superhuman strength and direction." I thought, "That'll do. I need every bit of that." And it's been that way for 35 years. How many years that is? 32 years since then. And it works just fine. I don't need to know who. Right? I know how. And I know where. Right here. If selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem, then love and service is the solution. Every time my sponsee calls, God says, "Love you, Laura." Every time somebody says, "Come fellowship," God says, "Love you, Laura." Every time somebody says, "There's this crazy woman and she's drunk," I'm like, "Get out of my way. I got her. Right? It's a hug from my heart. Because if I can be a life of sane usefulness. The book doesn't promise me happy. We are. I'm free. And that's awesome. But that's not what I'm doing here. I'm useful. If I'm in the moment useful, I'm not in the moment in bondage of self. If I can be useful, now I can't get to useful by myself. I don't wake up in the morning and go, "You know what? I think I'm just going to care about others today." I don't. I wish I did. Right? I wake up and think, "I don't want to." And it doesn't matter what it is. You know what I mean? My brain's... The book says what I have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And thank God it doesn't say my spiritual condition. You'd have a different speaker. My spiritual condition has been tanked a million days. But if I take the same action, repetition strengthens and confirms. If I just read the black part, say it, and I pray it. I read it, but I pray it. I say, "God, please help me to continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear." Because if I'm just reading it, my mind will also be making a grocery list. Right? Or maybe thinking about how to plot your demise. Because I am that complex. I can be reading a prayer and plotting your demise at the same time. Right? That is not beyond me. So I say it out. I pray it. "God, please help me to continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, please help me to remember to turn to you. Please help me to clean up a mess if I've caused harm. Please help me to, share that with somebody else. Please help me to resolutely turn." There's the circle. There's the circle in step 10, right? I'm gonna own it. I'm gonna clean it up. I'm gonna tell somebody else about it. I'm gonna ask God to separate me from that which separates me from Him. And then resolutely turn my thoughts to someone I can help, because then I'm really out of, then I'm relieved. Now I'm free. When I do 10 and 11, 12 happens. That's the truth. If I practice 10 and 11, 12 comes at me in droves, right? I'm going to tell you a couple of stories real quick and then I'll be done. And February is a difficult month at my house, but so if I get emotional, just bear with me. It's very odd for me to get emotional, but it's February. I moved out to West Texas on accident once, and I didn't mean it, and I didn't want to be there as soon as I got there. It's horrible. Don't go there, y'all. Good people, great people, but God Almighty, it's awful out there. They ain't got no water. They ain't got no trees. Awful. Highways, potholes. It's just awful. Anyway, I ended up accidentally in West Texas, and I got out there, and I'd been studying the book for about 18 months. So, you know, I knew a lot. And I for sure knew that these people that had been sober for decades were doing it wrong. God uses what he has at his disposal. And so I got out there and they were doing it wrong. There's this little girl named Krista, and Krista had been coming in and out. This was 1993. Krista had been coming out in and out since 1983. And she came up to me and asked me for my phone number. And this old timer said, "Don't bother. She's never going to make it." Pissed me off. I thought, well, of course not, because you people have been trying to help her, but now I'm here. It's the truth. I gave Krista my phone number. There was another little gal coming in and out. She's a psychiatric patient. She had like 19 psychiatric diagnoses, and none of them were alcoholism, by the way. And she said, you know, "Can I have your phone number?" And this old timer said, "She's never going to make it. She's crazy. We don't mess with people like her." Maybe mad. So I gave her my phone number. I'm getting these calls from these two girls off and on, and February the 28th of 1994, I'm on the phone with the psychiatric patient, and she's explaining to me how she's suicidal, and she just didn't think she'd do this anymore. And I'm saying something very kind and loving back to her, like what was said to me, like maybe if you pull your head out of your butt and work the steps, you wouldn't be suicidal. And the phone rang, and it was my mother, and she was calling to tell me that with 8.5 years of sobriety, my father had taken his own life. And I was broken. And I was angry. And I clicked back over to Mackenzie, and I told her what had happened, and I said, "Send AA." And the God that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, I can't define it, but I can tell you that I believe to my core that nothing is wasted in God's economy within Alcoholics Anonymous. Because in that moment, which was my worst moment to date by a lot, Mackenzie heard what she would be doing to her daughter. And it ended it for her. And Mackenzie celebrated 30 years of sobriety last November the 10th. Not because of me at all. She tells me stuff like, "Do you remember when you told me that?" I think, "God, that's brilliant. I've never said that a day in my life." You know what I mean? But my world was shattered and I was angry. And when we say, and I hear people say in meetings, "I haven't found it necessary to take a drink," I for sure have. I have for sure found it necessary to take a drink. And that was one of them. And AA came and you sat around my kitchen table and you did exactly what you're supposed to do and you said all the right things and you took all the right action and you sounded like Charlie Brown's teacher. Right? It was just wah, 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 wah. I couldn't hear anything you were saying. And then the phone rang and it was Krista. She'd been drinking whiskey and taking Xanax, and she didn't know if she'd overshot the mark. She should come to my house. She should go to the emergency room, or she should drink some more whiskey and take some more Xanax. Krista didn't know anything about my dad, and she didn't care because Krista was dying. And I couldn't hear what you were saying to me that night, but I could hear what I was saying to Krista. And Krista called every 20 minutes until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And she'd get mad. I'd say, "Krista, this is alcohol." I'd say everything I needed to hear. And she'd, "Oh, my God." And she'd hang up the phone. She'd call back 20 minutes later because she forgot she called me. And I would love to tell you, there's a line in the book that says, "Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs." I thought that meant that I was going to learn about Alcoholics Anonymous and I was going to stay sober and then I was going to be able to help you. But what I can tell you is that my very life depends on me being with you. Because when the phone rings, and it will, right? If I'm with you, right, I am safe and protected. I have been placed in a position of neutrality. You are my position of neutrality. When I can't pray, because sometimes I quit praying. I get mad at God. I got a God that can take it, right? And I'll just tell him, like, "This is dumb. I'm out." Right? And I'll sulk for an hour. You know what I mean? And then I'll come back and go, "I'm sorry." Right? I think God must just get so irritated at me. But anyway, if I'm here and connected, right, I survive the certain trials and low spots that are in. 10 years ago, we got a phone call that my mamaw, who I adored, was dying. And would I come? And I went. I was the first one there. And she was laying in the bed moaning. She had Alzheimer's, and she'd been sick for a while. And she was laying in the bed. She was moaning. She was hurting. And I couldn't take it. And so I went over, got in the bed with her, and I leaned her forward a little bit. She said, my back. And so I got some lotion, and I rubbed the lotion on her back. And I leaned her head back to put her on the bed, and her head just ended up right here in the crux of my elbow. And she looked up at me, and she said, thank you so much. And I said, Mama, I love you. And she said, I love you more. And I put her head back down on the pillow. And the nurse came in, and I said, I need to go outside for a minute. And I went outside. And I said, God, I am so grateful that I did not drink every day to get me to a place where I am present for this woman that loved me unconditionally. She loved Alcoholics Anonymous like air. Now, she didn't think I had alcoholism, y'all, because we don't have alcoholism in our family, you know. But she loved you guys like crazy because you restored her granddaughter. And I became someone that she trusted and she called upon, right? All of my relationships are restored. I'm in right relationship with everyone I want to be in right relationship with. Because I've been sober long enough, there's some folks I'm just not interested in, and that's all right. December the 30th of 2016, that guy that drove me through the car wash and I were in a hospital room together, and our daughter delivered our granddaughter. And we were in there together, and we cut the cord together. And we started co-grandparenting because that relationship had been healed because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was an excellent big paw. And we lost him last year, and that was very hard for my girls. But we were square because of Alcoholics Anonymous. That little baby that was born December the 30th of 2016 came home with her mother to my house. And then her mama left. And she did not. I really see that coming. I can't tell you how much I really didn't see that coming. I had a best friend for a long time. Her name was Diane Dixon, and she was the well-behaved one. And we got sober together, and she was a district everything, area everything. She was a delegate. She served on the literature committee for the fourth edition of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. She was pretty. She was well-dressed. She was well-behaved, and she had a two-sided triangle. And 7 years ago, they called me and said, 6 years ago, Harper was 3 weeks old, they called me and said she had finally overshot the mark. She had become a bad lady. She lost her mind. She drank herself into a crack house and went brained, and she didn't know come here from Sikkim. And she finally received mercy 6 years ago in January. Alcoholics Anonymous is three sides to that triangle. And if all I'm doing is coming to meetings and all I'm doing is hanging out and fellowshipping, I have unity. I might be being a service. Maybe I make coffee or something, right? Maybe I pick up an ashtray or a coffee cup. But if all I'm doing is fellowshipping and being a service, the base of that foundation of that triangle is my recovery. But if I'm really working a program, as it's outlined in the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the unity and the service will follow. If I only have the unity and the service, we're going to bury you. I know, because I've done it, right? I lived like that for a while. And so today, yes, my priority is my recovery. I do 10, 11, 12 happens. But also, I'm committed to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm committed. If my granddaughter needs Alcoholics Anonymous, I want her to get the exact same Alcoholics Anonymous that I got. I don't want a period to be different. I don't want a comma to be different. I don't want a meeting to be different. I don't want a tradition to be changed. I want it to be exactly what I got. Because when I got here, I was 17 years old. There was no one in that meeting that looked like me. I needed to find other fellowship, but I didn't need to find another message. Yes, I needed young people AA, and I did it, and it was awesome. But the message of Alcoholics Anonymous was not changed for me. And if it had been, you'd have a different speaker. It is a privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is a privilege to be sober and carry this message. I love you guys. I love AA. Thanks, everybody, for listening.